All right, children. Are you sitting comfortably?
Then we shall begin.
Readers, welcome to the Halloween edition of the Book Report. We've got it all. Horror, paranormal occurrences, vampires, and even though I don't get the fascination, zombies. What is it with these undead dudes? We've dug through the vault, found classics, then mixed them in the cauldron. With new titles guaranteed to make the blood curdle. Ooh, grab your Halloween stash, Snickers, of course, being the top choice of the book report, and settle into your coffin, I mean chair, for the best books to crack open on Halloween. No tricks, all literary treats, as we turn to page one of this special edition of the book report. Readers, of course, everyone is talking about Stephen King's Dr. Sleep. We previewed that title earlier this month, so I dug deep and found a title King calls one of his favorites, Salem's Lot. Ben Mears has just returned to Jerusalem's Lot in the hopes that living in an old mansion, long the subject of town lore, will help him cast out his own devils and provide inspiration for his new book. But when two young boys venture into the woods and only one comes out alive, Mears begins to realize there may be something sinister at work. His hometown is under siege by forces of darkness far beyond his control. Ron McLarty narrates.
Dud had been the dump custodian since 1956, and his reappointment each year at town meeting was routine and by acclamation. He lived at the dump in a neat tar paper lean-to with a sign reading Dump Custodian on the skew-hung door. He had wangled a space heater out of that skinflint board of selectmen 3 years ago and had given up his apartment in town for good. He was a hunchback with a curious cocked head that made him look as if God had given him a final petulant wrench before allowing him out into the world. His arms, which dangled ape-like almost to his knees, were amazingly strong. It had taken four men to load the old hardware store floor safe into their panel truck to bring it out here when the store got its new wall job. The tires of the truck had settled appreciably when they put it in. But Dud Rogers had taken it off himself, cords standing out on his neck, veins bulging on his forehead and forearms and biceps like blue cables. He had pushed it over the east edge himself. Dud liked the dump. He liked running off the kids who came here to bust bottles, and he liked directing traffic to wherever the day's dumping was going on. He liked dump picking, which was his privilege as custodian. He supposed they sneered at him, walking across the mountains of trash in his hip waders and leather gloves, with his pistol in his holster, a sack over his shoulder, and his pocket knife in his hand. Let them sneer. There was copper core wire and sometimes whole motors with their copper wrappings intact, and copper fetched a good price in Portland. There were busted out bureaus and chairs and sofas, things that could be fixed up and sold to the antique dealers on Route 1. Dud rooked the dealers, and the dealers turned around and rooked the summer people. And wasn't it just fine the way the world went round and round? He'd found a splintered spool bed with a busted frame 2 years back, and had sold it to a faggot from Wells for $200. The faggot had gone into ecstasies about the New England authenticity of that bed, never knowing how carefully Dud had sanded off the "Made in Grand Rapids" on the back of the headboard. At the far end of the dump were the junked cars, Buicks and Fords and Chevys and you name it, and my God, the parts people left on their machines when they were through with them. Radiators were best, but a good four-barrel carb would fetch $7 after it had been soaked in gasoline. not to mention fan belts, taillights, distributor caps, windshields, steering wheels, and floor mats. Yes, the dump was fine. The dump was Disneyland and Shangri-La all rolled up into one. But not even the money tucked away in the black box buried in the dirt below his easy chair was the best part. The best part was the fires and the rats. Dud set parts of his dump on fire on Sunday and Wednesday mornings, and on Monday and Friday evenings. Evening fires were the prettiest. He loved the dusky, roseate glow that bloomed out of the green plastic bags of and all the newspapers and boxes. But morning fires were better for rats. Now, sitting in his easy chair and watching the fire catch and begin to send its greasy black smoke into the air, sending the gulls aloft, Dud held his .22 target pistol loosely in his hand and waited for the rats to come out. When they came in battalions. They were big, dirty gray, pink-eyed. Small fleas and ticks jumped on their hides. Their tails dragged after them like thick pink wires. Dud loved to shoot rats. "You buy a powerful slug of shells, Dud," George Midler down at the hardware store would say in his fruity voice, pushing the boxes of Remingtons across. "Town pay for 'em?" This was an old joke. Some years back, Dud had put in a purchase order for 2,000 rounds of hollow point .22 cartridges, and Bill Norton had grimly sent him packing.
"Now," Dud would say, "you know this is purely a public service, George."
There. That big fat one with the gimpy back leg was George Midler. Had something in his mouth that looked like a shredded piece of chicken liver.
We've just heard Salem's Lot by Stephen King. Like father, like son, novelist Joe Hill has learned from the master, who just happens to be his dad, the aforementioned Stephen King. Joe's newest novel, NOS 482, has been a bestseller. We previewed that title recently, and look for it on BookReportRadio.com, archived books, week of June 22, 2013. One of Joe's earlier novels, Horns, is soon to be a major motion picture starring Harry Potter himself, Daniel Radcliffe. So let's take a sneak peek. Ignatius Parrish spends a night drunk and doing terrible things. He wakes the next morning with a thunderous hangover, a raging headache, and a pair of horns growing from his temples. At first, Ig thinks the horns are a hallucination, the product of a mind damaged by grief. He's spent the last year grieving for his beloved girlfriend, Marin, who'd been raped and murdered under inexplicable circumstances. Once Ig had enjoyed his life, born into privilege, the second son of a renowned musician and younger brother of a rising late-night TV star. But Marin's death damned all that. A suspect in the crime, Ig was never charged or tried, nor was he cleared in the court of public opinion. Nothing Ig can do, nothing he can say matters. Everyone, it seems, has abandoned him. Everyone that is, but the devil inside. Now Ig is possessed of a terrible new power to go with his terrible new look, a macabre talent he intends to use to find the monster who killed Marin and destroyed his life. Fred Berman narrates.
Ignatius Martin Parrish spent the night drunk and doing terrible things. He woke the next morning with a headache, put his hands to his temples, and felt something unfamiliar. A pair of knobby, pointed protuberances. He was so ill, wet-eyed and weak, he didn't think anything of it at first, was too hungover for thinking or worry. But when he was swaying above the toilet, he glanced at himself in the mirror over the sink and saw he had grown horns while he slept. He lurched in surprise, and for the second time in 12 hours, he pissed on his feet. He shoved himself back into his khaki shorts, he was still wearing yesterday's clothes, and leaned over the sink for a better look. They weren't much as horns went, each of them about as long as his ring finger, thick at the base, but soon narrowing to a point as they hooked upward. The horns were covered in his own too pale skin, except at the very tips, which were an ugly, inflamed red, as if the needle points at the ends of them were about to poke through the flesh. He touched one and found the point sensitive, a little sore. He ran his fingers along the sides of each and felt the density of bone beneath the stretched, tight smoothness of skin. His first thought was that somehow he had brought this affliction upon himself. Late the night before, he had gone into the woods beyond the old foundry to the place where Merrin Williams had been killed. People had left remembrances at a diseased black cherry tree, its bark peeling away to show the flesh beneath. Merrin had been found like that, clothes peeled away to show the flesh beneath. There were photographs of her placed delicately in the branches, a vase of pussy willows, Hallmark cards warped and stained from exposure to the elements. Someone, Merrin's mother probably, had left a decorative cross with yellow nylon roses stapled to it and a plastic virgin who smiled with the beatific idiocy of the functionally retarded. He couldn't stand that simpering smile. He couldn't stand the cross either, planted in the place where Merrin had bled to death from her smashed-in head. He turned his head this way and that, studying himself in the mirror, lifting his fingers to touch the horns once and again. How deep did the bone go? Did the horns have roots pushing back into his brain? At this thought, the bathroom darkened as if the light bulb overhead had briefly gone dim. The welling darkness, though, was behind his eyes, in his head, not in the light fixtures. He held the sink and waited for the feeling of weakness to pass. He saw it then. He was going to die. Of course he was going to die. Something was pushing into his brain, all right. A tumor. The horns weren't really there. They were metaphorical, imaginary. He had a tumor eating his brain, and it was causing him to see things. And if he was to the point of seeing things, then it was probably too late to save him. The idea that he might be going to die brought with it a surge of relief, a physical sensation like coming up for air after being underwater too long. Ig had come close to drowning once and had suffered from asthma as a child, and to him, contentment was as simple as being able to breathe. "I'm sick," he breathed. "I'm dying." It improved his mood to say it out loud. He studied himself in the mirror, expecting the horns to vanish now that he knew they were hallucinatory, but it didn't work that way. The horns remained.
That was Horns by Joe Hill. Seth Graham Smith delivers the definitive, essential guide to making it through a horror movie in one piece in How to Survive a Horror Movie: All the Skills to Dodge the Kills. As hilarious as it is useful if you're trapped in a scary flick, How to Survive a Horror Movie covers all the bases. Trapped in a haunted house? Check. Stalked by an evil doll? TKO. Wandering aimlessly through as plagues of zombies sweep over the planet? Got it. Graham Smith's delightfully gruesome guide is just the thing for the horror buffs or anyone who's ever watched a scary movie. Johnny Heller narrates.
Welcome to the Terrorverse. Dr. Loomis, death has come to your little town, Sheriff. Now you can either ignore it or you can help me to stop it. Halloween, 1978. Those of us who've become trapped in a horror movie have a choice. We can either line up with the other cattle and march into the slaughterhouse, or we can fight back. Yes, it's a long way to the final credits. No, the odds aren't in our favor, but that's no excuse to lie down and let the filmmakers have their way with us. Choose to learn the new rules. Choose to use them in your favor. Choose life. How do I know if I'm in a horror movie? Horror movie characters aren't killed by machete-wielding monsters or reincarnated psychopaths. They're killed by ignorance. Ignorance of the mortal danger they're in, of the butcher lurking in every shadow, of the new rules. Ignorance of the fact that they're in a horror movie. How do you know if you've been sucked into the Terrorverse? Sometimes the signs are unmistakable. For instance, if you're a teenaged babysitter caring for a mute toddler in a remote Maine cabin during a once-in-a-century blizzard, while an escaped killer, bearing a strange resemblance to the handicapped boy you and your friends bullied off an embankment and left for dead all those years ago, roams the woods, you're probably in a horror movie. But unless you've landed in the sloppiest of direct-to-video hack jobs, the clichés are going to be more subtle, your screenwriter more inventive, and your survival less likely. 1. Determine how you came to own this book. In movies, things rarely happen without a reason. Therefore, the simple fact that you're holding a book called How to Survive a Horror Movie means someone's probably trying to tell you something. Think hard. How did you end up holding this book? I'm just browsing in a bookstore. There's still a chance it's just coincidence. Be warned, though, if you take this thing to the counter and buy it, your chances of being in a horror movie go through the roof. I ordered it online. This is not good. Computers can be a gateway to unspeakable evil. Perhaps you were merely enticed by the gorgeous cover, an incredibly reasonable price. Someone gave it to me as a gift. Yikes. Getting a book called How to Survive a Horror Movie as a gift, that's like giving a young Liz Taylor How to Survive a Divorce. Oh, I just thought it'd make a nice gift, Liz. I'm sure you'll never need it. I found it in the woods. There's only one genre that would allow clumsy, contrived screenwriting like that. Proceed directly to Slasher Survival School. 2. Take a look around. The environment should offer some clues. If you're on a crowded city street in broad daylight, you're probably safe, for now. But if you're anywhere remote, the woods, an old house, an abandoned mental institution in the middle of a blackout, then yes, your chances of being in a horror movie are much higher. How the location looks and sounds can be helpful, too. Does everything look slightly grainy? This could indicate that you're being shot on film, or that you're developing cataracts. Either way, not good. Is it poorly lit? Is everything bathed in bright blue light, even though it's supposed to be nighttime? Are there shadowy corners that you should be able to see into, but can't? What is the set decoration like? Can you see children's sidewalk chalk drawings that should have washed away ages ago? Is everything suddenly covered in cobwebs or rust? Is there a thin layer of smoke on the ground for no reason? Do you hear strange sounds? Do strange chee-chee-chee, ah-ah-ah, or metal-on-metal noises seem to come out of nowhere? Does music crescendo every time you open a door? Are you speaking Japanese? According to the laws of early 21st century cinema, anyone speaking Japanese is in a horror movie. If the answer to any of these questions is affirmative, then we have to consider the possibility that you become trapped in a horror movie.
That was How to Survive a Horror Movie by Seth Graham Smith. In J.R. Rain's The Body Departed, James Blakely is a good man who has done some bad things in his time. So when he's viciously gunned down in his sleep, he's faced with a choice. Proceed immediately to an afterlife of eternal damnation, or haunt the world of the living in search of redemption and one last shot at heaven. Now, little more than a flickering shade of the man he was, James spends his days seeking solace from the loved ones he left behind, even as he works furiously to unravel the mystery of his murder. Solving the crime and saving his soul will force James to confront the darkest secrets in his past. With his ghost body disintegrating, time is running out. The fires of hell are rising, but will they purify Blakely's tormented soul or consume it? Peter Burkrot performs the book.
At that moment, a very large, balding man stepped into the copy room. He flicked on the light switch and ignored me completely and opened the copy machine's lid. He punched in the number 30 and proceeded to run off 30 copies of what appeared to be a drawing of a pizza. Aw, fractions. While the copy machine chugged away, he shivered and rubbed his arms and looked around absently, and perhaps a little uneasily. His very weak sixth sense was picking up on me. When his copies were finished, he turned to leave, but then paused in the doorway. The fine hairs on the back of his neck, I saw, were standing on end. He slowly, slowly turned around and appeared to look directly at me. Did he see me? I didn't know. I doubted it. A small part of his brain knew I was there, but could he trust that part of his brain? Most people didn't. He continued staring at me. I stared back at him. Somewhere down the hallway, a phone rang. Someone answered it. He blinked first, shivered once. When he was gone, I went to work. As a ghost, I could draw energy from most anywhere. From the air, from the sun, from the living, and even from electronics. Especially from electronics. Ghosts and electronics were made for each other, which was why lights in a house often flickered during a haunting. Ghosts, you see, used the electricity that fed the lights as an energy source to materialize. And so, now, with the help of the copy machine, I began to materialize. And as I did so, the lights from its display panel flickered wildly, and the whole thing sort of groaned like something old and dying. I felt myself taking shape. First, my torso formed. Then, in a sort of rippling wave of solidity, my arms and legs and fingers and toes appeared. I turned my hand over, watching it congeal before my eyes, opening and closing my fingers, making a fist. I sucked more energy from the machine, from the air, from anywhere and everywhere I could find it. Galvanized and crackling with life, I imagined this was how Frankenstein's monster felt when that lightning storm struck. Where's Igor when you need him? Solid and fully formed and feeling more alive than I had in a long, long time, I was just about to get to work when the secretary appeared in the doorway. Head down and holding a piece of paper she no doubt intended to copy, she absently reached for the light switch and then paused mid-reach. Her head snapped up and she gasped. How she didn't scream, I don't know. She put a hand over her chest and calmed herself. Oh my God, you scared me. I didn't think anyone was in here. I just smiled and nodded, and prayed she wouldn't continue reaching for the light switch. My bullet wounds would have been hard to miss in this form.
I'll come back, she said, backing away. Do you need any light?
I shook my head and she stared at me for another moment, then turned and hustled off. I knew I didn't have much time. Ghost or no ghost, a strange man standing alone in the copy room, with the lights out no less, would warrant an investigation. I moved quickly over to the shelf filled with yearbooks. I figured the killer, Eli, was in his late 20s. If so, that would have put him in high school about 10 years ago. Which, if my math was right, would have made him about 8 years younger than I was. So I started pulling down yearbooks that corresponded with those dates. I pulled out 4 yearbooks and opened the cover to the first, and briefly reveled in my solidity. I was nearly 100% congealed, and I felt almost human. Well, human enough to turn the pages of a book, which I did now, flipping rapidly to the high school portraits, scanning faces, looking for the killer.
We've just heard The Body Departed by J.R. Rain. Ever since horror leapt from popular fiction to the silver screen, viewers have experienced fear and pleasure in exquisite combination. Wheeler Winston Dixon's A History of Horror offers a comprehensive survey of this popular film genre. Arranged by decades, this one-stop source book unearths the historical origins of characters including Dracula, Frankenstein, and the Wolfman, and their various incarnations in film from the silent era to comedic sequels. Dixon examines over 50 timeless horror films, zooms in on top horror websites, and champions the stars, directors, and subgenres that make the horror film so incredibly popular. Aaron Henkin narrates.
The horror films released from the 1970s onward had little in common with their predecessors, save for one central aspect. They genuinely horrified viewers. It is hard to imagine audience members fainting dead away at the sight of Boris Karloff in Frankenstein, but it is so. Edward Van Sloan's friendly warning at the beginning of the film had been necessitated by Karloff's shocking countenance and, of course, by the subject matter. Living beings constructed from the corpses of the dead, hunchbacks, mad scientists, the drowning of a young girl, it was all too much for audiences to bear. 40 years later, Frankenstein was a venerable antique, a blueprint that had outlived its usefulness. Unless, of course, one increased the level of violence and mayhem with copious amounts of gore as window dressing. This period also witnessed the decline and total collapse of the Hollywood studio system, allowing independent filmmakers with minuscule resources access to the marketplace. This trend, of course, would last for only a short time, perhaps 10 years, 15 at the most, before the conglomerates would once again hold unquestioned power over the new anonymous multiplexes that sprang up in the late 1970s through the present era. But for a time, if you had $100,000 or so, and enough talent, guts, and imagination to offer something that the majors were afraid to touch, you had a shot at breaking through to the mainstream audience. This strategy, of course, is how independent filmmakers have always competed against the majors, by offering the public a fresh, often outlaw vision that the bigger studios were either unwilling or unable to duplicate. One couldn't compete on budgets. The majors would beat you every time. But you could, as AIP did, offer films that appealed directly to a younger, edgier audience and lure away a significant group of viewers. In time, these breakaway audiences would become dominant, and the cycle would start all over again, with some new auteur on the block presenting a spectacle that, once again, pushed the outer edges of the envelope. And horror films, as we've seen, by definition, operate on the cinematic margins, continually redefining what it is that truly horrifies us, frightens us, even repulses us. Otherwise, they cease to be truly horrific. The splatter pioneer Herschel Gordon Lewis, whose Blood Feast, 1963, shot in Miami on a budget of roughly $25,000, sensed this when he created the first truly ultra-violent film with copious amounts of gore and sadism, and was universally reviled for it. Yet, nearly a half century later, the brutality and senseless slaughter of Blood Feast have been replicated by so many contemporary horror films that we can see, whether we like it or not, where the horror film was headed. Lewis, known as the Wizard of Gore, went on to create a series of these ultra-low-budget, nearly plotless films with amateurish acting, inept direction, and seemingly endless scenes of graphic violence, each film more repellent than the last. 2000 Maniacs, 1964, which boasted a somewhat larger budget, features one scene in which a woman is ritually dismembered. In another sequence, a man is pushed down a hill inside a barrel with spikes driven through it, until all that remains is a bloodied corpse. Lewis correctly assessed that the film was repulsive psychologically and knew that he was appealing to the lowest common denominator in his audiences. But he simply didn't care. For Lewis, it was all about box office receipts. As he put it, if you cannot titillate your audiences with production value, you must titillate them with some type of edge. Indeed, Lewis's imagination in this regard was limited solely by meager budgets. For years, he wanted to blow someone up on the screen with a swallowed stick of dynamite, but gave up because he couldn't figure out how to do it for a reasonable amount of money. And despite Lewis's renegade status, or perhaps because of it, French critics in L'Observateur, Cahiers du Cinéma, and Images et Sons compared Lewis's audaciously violent films with Polanski's Repulsion and Hitchcock's Psycho. But, as Lewis knew, that isn't the way you keep score. You keep score through net film rentals. Thus, such later Lewis films as A Taste of Blood, 1967, and The Gore Gore Girls, a.k.a. Blood Orgy, 1972.
That was A History of Horror by Wheeler Winston Dixon. The Zombie Survival Guide, Complete Protection from the Living Dead, by Max Brooks, yes, Mel Brooks's son, is your key to survival against the hordes of the undead who may be stalking you. The book covers everything you need to know, including how to understand zombie physiology and behavior, the most effective defense tactics and weaponry, ways to outfit your home for a long siege, and how to survive and adapt in any territory. Mark Cashman performs the book that offers proven tips for safeguarding yourselves and your loved ones against the living dead.
The Undead, Myths and Realities. He comes from the grave, his body a home of worms and filth. No life in his eyes, no warmth of his skin, no beating of his breast. His soul, as empty and dark as the night sky. He laughs at the blade, spits at the arrow, for they will not harm his flesh. For eternity, he will walk the earth, smelling the sweet blood of the living, feasting upon the bones of the damned. Beware, for he is the living dead. Obscure Hindu text, circa 1000 BCE. Zombie, noun, also zombies, plural. 1. An animated corpse that feeds on living human flesh. 2. A voodoo spell that raises the dead. 3. A voodoo snake god. 4. One who moves or acts in a daze, like a zombie, a word of West African origin. What is a zombie? How are they created? What are their strengths and weaknesses? What are their needs, their desires? Why are they hostile to humanity? Before discussing any survival techniques, you must first learn what you are trying to survive. We must begin by separating fact from fiction. The Walking Dead are neither a work of black magic nor any other supernatural force. Their origin stems from a virus known as solanum, a Latin word used by Jan van der Haven, who first discovered the disease. Solanum, the virus. Solanum works by traveling through the bloodstream from the initial point of entry to the brain. Through means not yet fully understood, the virus uses the cells of the frontal lobe for replication, destroying them in the process. During this period, all bodily functions cease. By stopping the heart, the infected subject is rendered dead. The brain, however, remains alive but dormant, while the virus mutates its cells into a completely new organ. The most critical trait of this new organ is its independence from oxygen. By removing the need for this all-important resource, the undead brain can utilize, but is in no way dependent upon, the complex support mechanism of the human body. Once mutation is complete, this new organ reanimates the body into a form that bears little resemblance, physiologically speaking, to the original corpse. Some bodily functions remain constant, others operate in a modified capacity, and the remainder shut down completely. This new organism is a zombie, a member of the living dead. 1. Source. Unfortunately, extensive research has yet to find an isolated example of selenium in nature. Water, air, and soil in all ecosystems from all parts of the world have turned up negative, as have their accompanying flora and fauna. At the time of this writing, the search continues. 2. Symptoms. The timetable below outlines the process of an infected human, give or take several hours depending on the individual. Hour 1. Pain and discoloration, brown-purple, of the infected area. Immediate clotting of the wound, provided the infection came from a wound. Hour 5. Fever, 99 to 103 degrees Fahrenheit. Chills, slight dementia, vomiting, acute pain in the joints. Hour 8. Numbing of extremities and infected area. Increased fever, 103 to 106 degrees Fahrenheit. Increased dementia, loss of muscular coordination. Hour 11. Paralysis in the lower body. Overall numbness, slowed heart rate. Hour 16. Coma. Hour 20. Heart stoppage, zero brain activity. Hour 23, reanimation.
That was a sampling of the Zombie Survival Guide by Max Brooks. Readers, there's no better way to end this special Halloween show than with the complete short stories of Edgar Allan Poe, performed by Bob Thomley. Yes, the classics are still here. The Raven, The Mask of the Red Death, The Pit and the Pendulum, The Telltale Heart. But you'll also hear some tales that will be new to you, entertaining in ways you may not have expected from the famously horrific author. A story for every mood. So here we go, Mr. Poe.
For the most wild, yet most homely narrative which I'm about to pen, I neither expect nor solicit belief. Mad indeed would I be to expect it, in a case where my very senses reject their own evidence. Yet mad I am not, and very surely do I not dream. But tomorrow I die, and today I would unburden my soul. My immediate purpose is to place before the world, plainly, succinctly, and without comment, a series of mere household events. In their consequences, these events have terrified, have tortured, have destroyed me. Yet I will not attempt to expound them. To me they have presented little but horror. To many they will seem less terrible than baroques. Hereafter, perhaps, some intellect may be found which will reduce my phantasm to the commonplace. Some intellect more calm, more logical, and far less excitable than my own, which will perceive in the circumstances I detail with awe nothing more than an ordinary succession of very natural causes and effects. From my infancy I was noted for the docility and humanity of my disposition. My tenderness of heart was even so conspicuous as to make me the jest of my companions. I was especially fond of animals, and was indulged by my parents with a great variety of pets. With these I spent most of my time, and never was so happy as when feeding and caressing them. This peculiarity of character grew with my growth, and in my manhood I derived from it one of my most principal sources of pleasure. To those who have cherished an affection for a faithful and sagacious dog, I need hardly be at the trouble of explaining the nature or the intensity of the gratification thus derivable. There is something in the unselfish and self-sacrificing love of a brute which goes directly to the heart of him who has had frequent occasion to test the paltry friendship and gossamer fidelity of mere man. I married early, and was happy to find in my wife a disposition not uncongenial with my own. Observing my partiality for domestic pets, she lost no opportunity of procuring those of the most agreeable kind. We had birds, goldfish, a fine dog, rabbits, a small monkey, and a cat. This latter was a remarkably large and beautiful animal, entirely black, and sagacious to an astonishing degree. In speaking of his intelligence, my wife, who at heart was not a little tinctured with superstition, made frequent allusion to the ancient popular notion which regarded all black cats as witches in disguise. Not that she was ever serious upon this point, and I mention the matter at all for no better reason than it happens just now to be remembered. Pluto, this was the cat's name, was my favorite pet and playmate. I alone fed him, and he attended me whenever I went about the house. It was even with difficulty that I could prevent him from following me through the streets. Our friendship lasted in this manner for several years, during which my general temperament and character, through the instrumentality of the fiend Intemperance, had, I blush to confess it, experienced a radical alteration for the worse. I grew, day by day, more moody, more irritable, more regardless of the feelings of others. I suffered myself to use intemperate language to my wife. At length, I even offered her personal violence. My pets, of course, were made to feel the change in my disposition. I not only neglected, but ill-used them. For Pluto, however, I still retained sufficient regard to restrain me from maltreating him, as I made no scruple of maltreating the rabbits, the monkey, or even the dog, when, by accident or through affection, they came in my way. But my disease grew upon me. For what disease is like alcohol? And at length, even Pluto, who was now becoming old and consequently somewhat peevish, even Pluto began to experience the effects of my ill temper.
We've just heard the complete short stories of Edgar Allan Poe.
Weren't those delightful stories, children? Now, always remember, you don't need to be afraid of the dark.
Just be afraid of what's in it.
Well, boys and ghouls, the sun is coming up, and it's time for this year's Halloween edition of the Book Report to creep back into the crypt for another year. Who knows what mysterious mischief fiendish authors will come up with in the year to come. Many bloody tales, I'm sure, filled with type O's. Meanwhile, this All Hallows Eve, lock your doors, light your jack-o'-lanterns, and curl up with a good book. As always, thanks for listening, and see you back here next week on the Book Report.